Welcome to Her Leading Story, a podcast that will inspire you with stories from amazing female leaders and give you some ideas to help you design a life and a career that's perfect for you. It's totally doable, and the good news is that you'll have me and our community of leading women by your side every single step of the way. Let's get started. I'm your host, Julie Artis, and this is Her Leading Story. Welcome to this week's episode of Her Leading Story. I am so excited every week, but especially this week because I am interviewing Christy Ford, who is a high school teacher at Boyd County High School. And I'm going to let her talk a little bit more about what her current role is, and then we'll go back and talk a little bit more about her career. But the reason that I'm excited to talk to her is because I've known her since we were five or six. We grew up together.
A long time, Julie.
A long time. We grew up together in Eastern Kentucky and have stayed in touch, see each other on occasion when I'm back visiting. And I have been following what she's been doing at her current position that she's in at her high school. And I just thought it would be great to have her on to talk a little bit about what she's doing now, and then also talk some about her career path in that theme of we can all be leaders. So Christy, why don't you tell everybody here what your current role is and what you do in your high school?
I am currently a JAG specialist. JAG stands for Jobs for America's Graduates. It's a national nonprofit that seeks to remove obstacles for students who might not otherwise have a positive outcome after high school. A positive outcome can mean trade school. It can mean going straight into the workforce. It can mean military service, or it can mean a four-year college or any combination thereof. It is a three-tiered approach. We deal with providing services. A lot of my kids are housing and food insecure. Mm-hmm. We deal with grade level and academic intervention and employment, employability skills. And then all of those are together. We deal with trauma. It's a trauma-informed teaching style that we use.
And you've been doing this for a couple years?
This is my second academic year. I feel like I've been doing what I'm doing for a long time.
Yeah.
But this is my job all day long now. I was an English teacher in my previous life.
And is this new at your high school, or had it already been a program that was going?
I started this program at my high school.
Oh, wow. So what did that involve?
A lot of saying yes, and that's not something that I'm very good at. I don't know if you remember George Stafford. Do you remember George Stafford?
Yeah.
George Stafford is my executive director. I know that doesn't mean anything to your listeners, but he went to high school with Julie and me too. And he came to my high school and talked to my principal and said, we're trying to expand this program into Eastern Kentucky. Do you know of anybody that might be good for this kind of work? And my principal said, I actually do know somebody that this seems like might be her dream job. And he was right. So they have a contract with our school, and I had to interview for the job, which was, I don't want to start on why I had to interview for that job, because I think that was fucking ridiculous. But nonetheless, I had to interview for the job. And once I got a look at the curriculum and the philosophy, I really couldn't say no, because it was all of the things that were keeping me in education. All of the kinds of things that I did during the course of a day that were keeping me a teacher. So it was an easy yes. That one was an easy yes.
And so do the students in this program, do they take all their classes from you, or are you like a coordinator?
I'm one class period a day, but I usually see them multiple times during the day. We have an hour class period, which serves as an elective in their day. And then I have a guidance block at lunch, and they can come in and they drop in and out during the guidance block. And then if they've got something else going on, they can come down to my room. Other teachers know what's going on to a degree. They know what we're about. And so I typically see my students at least twice during the course of a day, sometimes more than that.
Yeah. I think when we were speaking, when I was home, that you were talking about how students are, quote unquote, eligible to participate in this.
Right. So there are qualifiers, is what they call them. But they're like any other person would probably call them a strike against a kid. And they're, you know, kids that, and we knew kids growing up that, like, they lived with a grandmother, or they had failed a grade, or they had a parent in jail, or they had a parent who had died, or they didn't speak the language, or they had addiction disorder in their family, or whatever it is. Any one of those things is considered an obstacle. To be in JAG, a student has to have at least 7. And the average number of the students that I teach is 18 of those.
Dang.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a lot.
It has been a sobering experience. Several years ago, do you know the book Dreamland by Sam Quinones?
I was hoping you would talk about this, actually.
Okay, so a few years ago, before pre-pandemic, I had read his book, which is a book about how black tar heroin found its way to Eastern Kentucky. Mm. And I thought that it would be interesting for my students to see the economic effects, that might be a way of communicating to them why they shouldn't be participating in the addiction industry in Eastern Kentucky. And I asked my students to write an impact statement because I wanted to know where there might be triggers. Because I did know that I had a couple of students who had lost parents to heroin overdose or opioid overdose. And they were anonymous statements, but I asked them to tell me how opioids had had a personal effect on them. And that year I had, across my classes, I had about 142 students. And it was about 82% of my students had a family member, a close friend, or they themselves were actively addicted, in recovery, in jail, or dead from an overdose. 82%. 82% of my kids. And they talk about aha moments.
Yeah.
That was mine. I'm like, what in the hell am I doing teaching them about gerunds?
Right.
You know? Why should they give the first shit about Hamlet or any of that? I mean, I know why they should academically and cognitively. I know that they still need to know those things, but it was chilling. And it did change everything about the way that I taught and about the way that I approach my students. And I feel stupid because I thought that I had a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I thought I was on top of this because I was asking them. I'm like, yeah, look at me. I'm progressive. Let me in my very sheltered way ask you, how has heroin fucked up your life?
Yeah.
And it was 82% of my kids and it was like, there were some, Julie, that were like, it really hasn't had an effect, but I do know that Mama sucks all the coating off of her pills so that it works faster. So anyway, what I found was, this had been a kind of a pattern. I know you talk about leading in academia and in education tends to mean that you're promoted to dealing with the kids who are, there's my dogs, I apologize, dealing with people who, like, you get moved up to deal with the students who are in the more advanced classes.
Right.
And when I started, I taught in college before. And then I moved to public education. And when I went to teach in high school, I was teaching the kids who were the advanced academic, the pre-AP, all of that stuff.
The police are here.
The police are here.
Right.
Interesting.
Do you need to?
I don't know. The police are at my house. We'll see. Interesting. Okay. So anyway, this is how I relate to my kids. No, anyway. So anyway, people are usually promoted that way.
Yeah. Like you teach AP or, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I did teach AP and I taught the dual credit classes and all of that stuff. But I kept finding myself asking, can I just teach English 4? Can I just have the kids who are struggling?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept getting away from teaching AP, giving up my dual credit classes, and finding my way to the kids who were, so to speak, the standard kids, the kids who might not be at grade level, the kids who were struggling with reading. After I did Dreamland, I asked if I could do credit recovery classes.
What does that mean?
Part of my day. That means kids who had failed classes and didn't have enough time during summer school to catch all the, or to redo all the classes that they needed to do. So they were like, they were taking English 3 while they should have been taking English 4. They were doing them at the same time. So I moved from English 4. I was already doing some credit recovery because I found there was a correlation, an obvious correlation between the kids who were having a lot of the addiction problems in their homes. We're also having a lot of academic problems at school.
Of course.
Yeah. And then this job, I was going to go to a full day of credit recovery. I had given up my English 4 classes over the summer before, and then they brought in this JAG program, and I was like, oh, I can do credit recovery. I can do academic intervention. I can do trauma. I can get these kids the services they need. And that became my all-day job. But
wow,
when you're dealing with things like the kinds of economic depression that we are dealing with in Eastern Kentucky and all of Appalachia, really pretty much every small town in the country, there's money thrown at it. There are recovery centers, there are drug courts. What we really need is we need education to play a bigger part in that equation. And this allows me to do that. There's a lot of fallout that people fail to recognize from the overdose numbers. It's very easy to become fatigued by those numbers and to dehumanize those numbers and talk about what you would do and what you wouldn't do if somebody overdosed in front of you. But yeah. When you're teaching the kids who are left behind and you're teaching the kids who are having to use the Narcan on their parents, it's a lot harder to allow yourself to become fatigued, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So this, in the grander scheme of things, it looks like I am not leading anymore. If a teacher came in that was new and saw me teaching this class or teaching credit recovery, they would assume that I had done something to deserve being in that situation, mm-hmm. that I had been demoted. I chose to be there. Mm-hmm. I choose to be there every day. And I mean, to hell with what people think. I know what I'm doing, but it's sort of like, it is sort of like leading from behind. I don't know how to say that. I'm trying to tie it to your mission statement. But
listen, it is totally consistent with what I'm doing on this podcast. My question for you is, how did you know that working with these kids was right for you? Like, what was it? I mean, you and I were in the AP classes together. We were quote unquote good students. We got grad degrees. Well, okay, maybe I was a good
student.
You
were a good student. I was not a good student.
Well, but you're
very smart. I was a great learner. I was not a good student.
But seriously, like, what was it inside you that felt like I know that teaching these AP classes and these advanced students is not right for me anymore? It might have been right for me at one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I'm feeling called to this. Do you know like what it was?
I think, as I've said, I think the book had something to do with it, but I'm not giving it all that credit. I think the book came along at a really good time or a really appropriate time in my development. But I do not have to think too long to know that my mother had something to do with it. And I'll explain that in a second. I would also say that I came to a point in my life where having children was no longer a viable option.
I see.
And I think that both of those things were inextricably tied to one another, losing a mother and then not being able to be a mother.
Yeah.
In the traditional sense, those things came to a head all at the same time. And my mother was a remarkable woman, and it's hard not to romanticize her. But she was built for serving people.
Yeah.
And she always taught us to have a giving and a serving heart. And that I thought was a little bit ridiculous when I was growing up, but yeah. I mean, I was in the Young Republicans, just like somebody else I know, once upon a time. And I don't want to categorize too simply, but being a servant and serving other people was not always at the top of my list of priorities. But Mom always pushed me toward that through example. When she got sick because she was doing Bible study at a women's prison, and they gave her the flu and she didn't recover. So the least I know that she died doing something that was important to her. As for the other, we live in a culture that tends to dismiss women of a certain age who do not have children. And yep. it was not a conscious decision not to have children. I always wanted kids. It didn't work out for me medically or my timing or whatever. It was not what I was supposed to do, I guess, if I'm listening to the universe. But I don't believe that makes me any less of a person or a human being. It doesn't invalidate my existence, but I do feel like it does not remove the responsibility of mothering and or caring for people. And like, I guess if it may sound too simple, but I had an instinct to take care of things, and yeah. My dogs and my husband weren't cutting it. So, so I had to, I mean, it wasn't conscious.
Yeah.
I mean, looking back on it, I know what I have done. And yeah. I'm not looking to replace anyone's mother, but I do spend an awful lot of my day mothering.
Yeah.
Modeling behavior, approving or disproving behavior, mm-hmm. helping people make better decisions. If you want, I mean, I'm doing the kind of mothering my mother did.
Right.
And that,
yeah.
It's a lot of disapproval. But I'm kidding. But I would also say that it wasn't until I started working with these kids that I realized that I had stuff in common with them. And I grew up in a very comfortable existence. I had a home, I had food, I had two parents. I had the things that I needed. Mm-hmm. I mean, my goodness, my needs were always met. What is it they say? You have to feed a belly before you can feed a heart. I always had those needs met, but I also realized that I had trauma.
Yeah.
There was trauma. And I didn't realize how it had marked me until I started dealing with these kids. And maybe that's what they mean by not understanding yourself fully until you parent, you realize the things. I don't know. I mean, yeah. Because I'm not, but nonetheless, that's what I think kept drawing me to these kids, whether I knew it or not.
Yeah.
I had a mother who taught me that it is the responsibility of people who can to do.
Yeah.
And I needed to mother. I
yeah.
needed to care for something.
Yeah. I mean, it's so clear to me that so many times when we get to this moment in our, say, 40s, mm-hmm. that we're like, what the hell am I doing? What mm-hmm. the hell? And we realized that we've been climbing this ladder, in my case, the degrees, the university job, the administrative job, tenure, blah, blah, blah. In your case, it was like getting your master's, teaching in colleges, teaching those AP students and all of that stuff. And then finding yourself in this moment, and it's not even like sometimes an existential crisis, right? It's more of like, something doesn't feel right. Like, I'm not, this isn't fulfilling to me right now.
Right.
And so I think I find one of the common things through all of the interviews that I've been doing is that we are better served when we're listening to ourselves that way.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's certainly true for me. If you are looking to make sure that there's a common thread with me, yes, I agree with that.
Yeah,
I agree entirely that it's very easy to get caught up in worrying about recognition or worrying about being seen by other people that we forget that we need to be listening to, recognizing and seeing ourselves. And sometimes it takes something awful to make you stop and look and listen. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just a bad day that, yeah, you have the, you look in the mirror and you go, oh, I think I might have messed up here. I might have made the wrong choice. I might have made a series of wrong choices. But mom, I lost mom. I nearly died myself. There was this pandemic. I don't think I'm alone in the existential crisis, but shoot, doesn't it feel like it sometimes in the middle of it where you're like, I feel so ungrateful for everything that I have, everything that I've worked for, everything that I thought was important. There's a lot of guilt associated too with redirecting your life.
Right.
Where you feel like you're just turning your back on everything that you've done before. But for me, it was absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
Although I will tell you that I'm currently teaching 3 English 4 classes on top of my stupid schedule because we lost a teacher. We're down 4 teachers this year in my high school.
Wow.
And one of them was the English 4 teacher. And I had to, I'm now double dipping.
Yeah.
And I, every minute that I teach the English classes, Julie, I'm like, thank God I don't do this anymore.
Wow.
I find it difficult to teach English when I cannot teach credibility and what research is without it being a political conversation. And it just doesn't feel like me in the classroom anymore.
Yeah.
I don't feel myself when I'm teaching English in the classroom anymore.
Huh.
So
interesting.
I know I did the right thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because you have forever and ever since I've known you been such a reader and a writer and drawn to like literature of all different sorts. Why don't you tell, like, let's back up, just, we don't have to do a long and winding road, but like, why English?
Okay.
Like, why English? Why teaching? Like, when you were in your 20s, like, why?
I spent most of my youth trying to avoid being a teacher. My grandmother was, I came from a long line of teachers, preachers, and doctors, and I didn't want to be any of those things. And I did everything in my power to avoid being a teacher and found myself not prepared to do anything. When I got out into the world, I was like, well, I'm going to be an English major because I'm going to write. Well, because that's the kind of stupidity and confidence that youth allows you. But I got out, I went, and I didn't have anywhere to go but home.
Yeah.
And I worked for my dad for a while in his office, as one does in Eastern Kentucky. And I got a job with AmeriCorps. I did 2 years of AmeriCorps. And I worked at Catlettsburg Elementary, which is in a nearby small town. It was a school for disadvantaged kids, mostly in a disadvantaged neighborhood. But so that school is so much more than that. Can I just say that out loud? I love Catlettsburg Elementary to this day. But the 2 years that I spent at Catlettsburg Elementary taught me what a complete and total dumbass I was about I don't know anything about the world. I don't know anything about myself. I don't know anything about what I'm supposed to be doing, except that, oh my gosh, I get such a bang out of teaching these kids how to read. I did a lot of service then too, because I was working with at-risk kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is everything. I love this. And then I went and got my master's degree in English, and it was very easy to keep teaching because you can't do anything else with a master's degree. And I was really good at it too. When I was at Marshall, I was teaching two sections, and TAs don't usually teach two sections. Usually you work in the writing lab or you teach a section, then you do tutoring. And then after my first semester, they had me teaching two classes. Then I was the Jaeger writing mentor. And then when I got a position as an instructor there, you know, in the graduate classes, they were sending the students who were there to learn how to teach. They were sending them to me to be my student teachers in my freshman little classes. So, I mean, it came easy.
Yeah.
English writing, those kinds of things. I mean, I'm verbal. I don't think that that's a surprise to anybody listening, because I won't shut up, but I'm very verbal. I'm good at writing. I'm good at reading. And I think maybe there was a path of least resistance kind of thing in the beginning, but I like being the person in the room that holds the information. That is one of my red flags.
Yeah.
I like being the person. You remember the line in Broadcast News where Sidney Pollack says to Holly Hunter, "It must be nice knowing you're the smartest person in the room." And she says, "No, it's awful.
It's awful.
It's not awful. It's not awful. It's not awful. I love it. I love knowing it. Yeah. I love knowing it. I get a bang out of it. But that's not, it's less and less true as I get older."
Yeah. Why did you leave Marshall and go to Boyd County High School?
It follows the pattern. I kept getting kids who didn't know how to do the things that they needed to do in freshman English and research. They did not have those skills mastered when they got to college. And I thought, well, there are a couple different things I could do. I could just stay pissed off my entire life and just keep passing the buck down. What the hell is wrong with high school teachers these days? Don't they know how to? I could go become a high school teacher and teach them how to do it myself. And that's what I did. I also really, really needed retirement, health benefits, all of those things that are less than wonderful sometimes in higher education when you don't have your terminal degree. And Mom, you know, I go back to Mom. I was accepted to four different doctoral programs, and then Mom got sick. And I did my list of pros and cons, and the pros were I would have a secure living, but that was about it. I would have my terminal degree, and that was about it. I would have the money that I had to put out for the money that I would make, and then leaving home for 4 years, all of those things, it didn't add up for me. And I don't have any regrets about that. I have no regrets about not having my PhD. I admire people who are able to accomplish it, and I feel confident that I could have, but I'm okay with the degree that I have.
Yeah.
But that's why. It's because, I mean, I could bitch about it or I could go fix it. And that tends to be, that is not something I ever, ever thought would be the direction that my life would take, because I so love bitching about things. That's my jam. My mom used to tell me, "Christy, it's not your job to tell people how they are fucking up." I would say, "But then why did God make me so good at it?" I love what I do. I want to make that abundantly clear. That I have not been this satisfied in education for many, many moons. But I'm not really a teacher anymore. I'm a social worker is what I am now. working undercover as a teacher. But it has highlighted so many things that are lacking. And that I'm too old now to go fix everything. Yeah. I want to keep following that path. I want to complete the pattern of what's wrong, let me go fix it. But I don't know how much more of that I have in me. I think that I have found a nice spot to stop and focus for this season of my life.
Yeah. And I mean, you're doing your work with these students, but I also know that you are also advocating for this at the state level to spread the program into more schools. Yes. So that kind of advocacy work, I think, is also true to who you are. And you're like, I'm going to bitch about this until it's fixed.
Yes. Yeah, that does. The squeaky wheel. Listen, one of the things I'm proudest of with this is also we talked about the fact that it's a step in the direction of fixing what the opioid crisis has done here. But we have a partnership we're in the development stages of partnerships with Marathon, with King's Daughters Hospital, with Solar Hauler, which is a solar energy organization or company here in this area, whereby our students are getting the opportunity to network with those organizations. They're getting opportunities to find out what potential employers expect of them. And I've got three that are being interviewed for an internship with Solar Hauler on Tuesday. I've got 7-8 more going to King's Daughters to do a job shadowing starting Monday. And I've got about 11 or 12 who've already filled out their applications to be laborers with the Marathon Marine Transportation. And so I can see improvement or the baby steps that we have to take, where we're taking those people who have been most deeply affected by this crisis and we're moving them towards positive and viable outcomes. And that to me is really empowering in a way that education isn't usually empowering anymore.
Oh, for sure.
And so I say I'm not a teacher, but I'm still a teacher.
Yeah, you're still a teacher. But it's also like, think about it from a local economy perspective. Like, you're also making these relationships with these companies in the area and who then become supporters of the kind of work that gets done in your program. Right. And then, you know, are able to see that these students, because I think what happens a lot of times is when you have so many quote unquote qualifiers, right, on your record as a student.
Right.
Right. It's like, I mean, there's not just the individual kind of like, oh, I'm terrible, not good enough, never going to get a job. But there's also like a stigma that you're really trying to push back against in the area about it and really change the conversation so that we're really seeing these kids as worthy citizens and human beings who deserve a shot at their lives and building a life for themselves and their families that isn't as troubled as the one that they grew up in.
It is a miraculous thing to watch a kid realize that at the same time that other people are realizing it because they don't know it.
Yeah.
When I told one of the young people Friday that they were being interviewed on Tuesday by Solar Hauler, I thought they were going to cry. They were so excited, wanted to call home. And that, because they just did not think that was something that was going to happen for them. And that is so cool. And I mean, I've had students articulate it just that way too, Julie. I don't want to be what I've come from. I want to have a house. I want to be able to offer my family things that I didn't have growing up. And the consciousness that is so vital to breaking cycles, it does not come naturally. And I think that people who don't have to break cycles don't understand. It's work. It's work. And it's not the kind of work that you can do easily or quickly. And it's work that has to, I mean, it's like, it's a recovery in and of itself. It's something you have to address every day.
And is probably best done in a community like the one that you're leading.
Yeah, listen, they know, and they form a tribe. They have their own tribe, and they belong to one another in a way that they don't belong to anything else in school. That is something that they've been on the outskirts of the community.
Yeah.
Listen, the first thing that, one of the things that I teach them, it's not necessarily the priority of JAG, but it is a priority of mine, is that when you want to become a part of a community, you have to learn how to take care of a community. Mm-hmm. And we do community service projects. And last year, when I asked them what they wanted to do as a community service project, they decided they wanted to put hygiene products in every classroom so that people who needed them could have access to them. And I was floored by that, because I thought, I mean, they constantly blow my mind, these kids. It was not something that I thought they were going to come up with. So, and specifically, they wanted period products.
Yeah.
And period products are freaking expensive.
Yeah.
So we've tried every kind of fundraiser. We've tried, and let me tell you something, men, I love men, but men are not necessarily down with this kind of conversation in Eastern Kentucky. And so when I would bring this to my administrators, they would just rub their temples.
Yeah.
But we applied for a grant with period.org, and they came through. That's always awesome. Just like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, Always shipped us 35,000 maxi pads. And
incredible.
Yeah. Oh my God. Calling maintenance. I need a forklift. What do you need a forklift for? Well, I've got 3 pallets of maxi pads that need to be brought into the school. And it's awesome because they just don't argue. They just come over, right? It's just like, I'm going to come over so I don't have to have this conversation anymore. And so they've put period products in every classroom in our high school. And I'm so proud of them. When they learn to value themselves, they also learn to value the contributions that they can make to other people. And this is something that they have done that I'm just like, I'm crazy proud of them.
Yeah.
Sometimes they move me to the point that I don't have words. And I think that
it's rare, people.
Rare. It's rare. But they do it. They do it very rarely.
Yeah. I want to take this as a moment to say that there is going to be in the show notes a link to an Amazon wish list for Christy's students that she keeps updated with things that either she needs for the classroom or could be related to fundraiser.
It's mostly snacks.
It's mostly snacks.
I'm not even going to lie. My kids are absolutely food insecure. I mean,
yeah.
And one of the ways that and thank you for that, by the way, the link, I mean,
yeah.
they, at the beginning, that was the way that I built some trust.
Yeah.
Was I would bring food, and it was hard for them to understand that the food was always going to be there. And so I'd bring food in and they would just be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would refill and it would just be gone. And then eventually what they figured out is that it was always going to be there and that they needed to leave some for other people in the other classrooms. And they'll bring stuff from their lunch that they don't eat and they'll share it, and they'll ask, can I take this home? And it is a weird thing food does to kids when they don't have enough of it.
Yeah.
And that is one of my priorities, is to always have food for them to eat. Even though we are free lunch school, nobody pays for lunch, nobody pays for breakfast, and the kids are still hungry. So I spend about $100 a week making sure that they're fed, and I don't begrudge them that. It's hard to keep up with them sometimes, but if somebody wanted to buy them some snacks, I would certainly be grateful, and I know they would be grateful, and I will let them know where it comes from.
Questions,
I
don't know.
That was all.
You.
It was all a very awkward way of saying, please send my kids food. Sure.
Sure. I have 2 other quick questions. One is, if you could give your 20, 22-year-old self some advice from this vantage point, what would you tell her?
Mm-hmm. I would tell her to relax a little bit and don't try to make it all happen at once. Whether that be work or friendship or love, the harder that I worked to try to make things happen, the more elusive they became. And that anxiety just cost me time. It didn't make anything happen more quickly. And I would just tell her to chill the hell out a little bit. Maybe get some mental health care way sooner than I did. But, you know,
yeah,
deal with the anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would tell her.
Are there any ways, and I'm just trying to think how this would have been in your case. Are there any ways that being a woman you think have advantaged you or disadvantaged you on this career path that you've had?
Education is one of those fields where the women do the work and the men do the administrating. I don't think administrating is actually work, but there certainly have been times that my voice was maybe initially dismissed because it was a female voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't deal easily with dismissal or underestimation. So if it was indeed a factor in how I was treated or how I was listened to, I didn't let it be for long. I think that my gift is, as alluded to before, telling people what they're not paying attention to and they need to. Mm-hmm. And I do use that. And I think that is a feminine gift. I do think it is a feminine gift that I have had to couch the things that I say. I've had to learn to say the things that I want to say, to have the influence that I want to have. I've had to couch that in that feminine way so that men will listen. Sure.
Yeah.
Like if you want to get ahead or if you want to remove that target from your back, you need to be doing this. And that everybody learns to work around it. But sure, it's absolutely there. I mean, look at the number of people who are teachers and that are women or female, and the number of people who are administrators and who are male. And there's certainly disparity.
Yeah.
Did it ever hold me back from saying what I wanted? No.
Yeah.
No. But they didn't listen to me. To their own peril.
Yeah.
Their own peril.
That's right. Well, I thank you so much for doing this interview.
I thank you for asking. It was so fun. I would do it anytime anybody wanted to listen to stuff that isn't answering the question.
Well, it's called Her Leading Story for a reason. It's supposed to be a story, not just me asking you questions.
Okay.
And you are a very good storyteller, Christy Ford. And I just thank you so much for the work that you're doing in my hometown and community and the work you're doing with those kids. It's just amazing. And I am thrilled to be able to share it far and wide.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Christy Ford as much as I did. I mean, seriously, this is one of my oldest friends, and I'm just so, so impressed with the work that she's doing, and I'm thrilled that she agreed to be interviewed. Some takeaways that I got from this conversation. First, about leadership. I mean, I mentioned this at the top of the episode, but I really want to drive this home, right? That leadership doesn't necessarily mean climbing into higher, better paying, more titled positions, right? Christy really followed her gut in a lot of situations, decided not to pursue her PhD, decided to step away from college to teach in high school. And while there were other forces that were sort of at play in the context of her life that guided her to make those decisions, ultimately it has landed her in finding work that's really, really meaningful to her, even though it seems to be the opposite of a promotion. She's really making an impact on her community. Second, I really was struck by Christy's reflections on her mom's role as a teacher, as somebody who did a lot of volunteer work and service, and how, at least when she was younger, this was something that she sort of turned away from or ran from. But as she'd gotten to her 40s, And now we're in our early 50s, you know, she ended up there. And I think the enduring influence and gift of her mother and her mother's work and her mother's memory has played a huge influence on the kind of work that Christy's drawn to and that she enjoys doing. And I think it's a big honor to her mother's legacy in this area that I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, where there's a lot of difficult situations. And as Christy says, we were both protected from them, the poverty and all of that. When we were younger, we were both privileged to grow up in households where we weren't food insecure. We always had a warm place to sleep. But nevertheless, around us were kids that were not in that kind of a position. And the kind of work that Christy's doing, I think, is really, really important, and maybe especially so in my hometown. So proud of her. The final point I want to make, this is my sociologist point coming out, is that none of us make decisions about the kind of work that we want to do in a vacuum, right? Like, there's this like deep and abiding and difficult opioid crisis in Eastern Kentucky and all through Appalachia. And that has deeply affected the lives of so many children, of so many teenagers, in so many different ways. And we can't really separate our personal decisions out from the context in which we are embedded, right? So Christy experiencing teaching high school English and then being confronted with the lived reality of the students in her high school, where, what was it she said? She did a survey and there were 82% of her kids had a family member, close friend, or they themselves were actively addicted in recovery, in jail, or dead from an overdose. It's just breathtaking and makes all the sense in the world why this was what she decided she needed to do. I think there's a lot of lessons here. And if you would please check out the show notes, I'm going to post a link there to her Amazon wish list. And if you're so moved by this and you want to send her kids some snacks for the classroom, it would be great if you would be willing to just, and you can totally do this anonymously. I'm going to put a link to her Amazon wish list for her classroom, and you can send things to her kids there. Anyway, I appreciate you. Excited that you were able to listen, and I will see you next week. And that's a wrap on this episode of Her Leading Story. If you love this episode, please help me reach more women by leaving a review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next week.
This has been an Awkward Sage production.